All I wanted was a job providing enough money to keep us alive and a little over so that I could do auric research, and all the offers I had was to write a silly book about myself. Some time before I had answered an advertisement for a technical writer for instruction books in connection with aircraft. By the evening mail I received a letter asking me to attend for an interview on the morrow. Ah! I thought, I may get this job at Crawley after all. Early the next morning, as I was having breakfast before going to Crawley, a letter dropped in the box. It was from Mr. B. _. You should write a book, the letter said. Think it over carefully and come and see me again. Pa, I said to myself, I should hate to write a book. Off I went to Clapham Station to get a train for Crawley. The train was the slowest ever, to my mind. It seemed to dawdle at every station and grind along the stretches between as if the engine or the driver was at the last gasp. Eventually I arrived at Crawley. The day was swelteringly hot now and I had just missed the bus. The next one would be too late. I plodded along through the streets, being misdirected by person after person, because the firm I was going to see was in a very obscure place. At long last, almost too tired to bother, I reached a long, unkempt lane. Walking along it I finally reached a tumble-down house which looked as if a regiment of soldiers had been billeted there. You wrote an exceptionally good letter, said the man who interviewed me. We wanted to see what sort of man could write a letter like that. I gasped at the thought that he had brought me all this way out of idle curiosity. But you advertised for a technical writer, I said, and I am willing for any test. Ah. Yes, said the man, but we have had much trouble since that advertisement was inserted. We are reorganizing and shall not take on anyone for 6 months at least. But we thought you would like to come and see our firm. I consider you should pay my fare, I retorted, as you have brought me here on a fool's errand. Oh, we cannot do that, he said. You offered to come for an interview, we merely accepted your offer. I was so depressed that the long walk back to the station seemed even longer. The inevitable wait for a train, and the slow journey back to Clapham. The train wheels beneath me seemed to say, you should write a book, you should write a book, you should write a book. In Paris, France, there is another Tibetan Lama who came to the West for a special purpose. Unlike me, circumstances decreed that he should evade all publicity. He does his job and very few people know that he was once a Lama in a Tibetan Lamasery at the foot of the Potala. I had written to him asking his opinion and, to anticipate a little, it was to the effect that I would be unwise to write. Clapham Station looked dirtier and dingier than ever, in my unhappy state of mind. I walked down the ramp to the street, and went home. My wife took one glance at my face and asked no questions. After a meal, although I did not feel like eating, she said, I telephoned Mr. B. _ this morning. He says you should do a synopsis and take it for him to see. Synopsis. The mere thought sickened me. Then I read the mail which had arrived. Two letters saying that the position had been filled. Thank you for applying, and the letter from my Lama friend in France. I sat down at the battered old typewriter which I had inherited from my predecessor, and started to write. Writing to me is unpleasant, arduous. There is no inspiration, nor have I any gift, I merely work harder than most at a subject, and the more I dislike it, the harder and faster I work so that it is the sooner completed. The day drew to a weary end. The shadows of dusk filled the streets and were dispelled as the street lamps came on to shed a garish glow over houses and people. My wife switched on the light and drew the curtain. I typed on. At last, with stiff and aching fingers, I stopped. Before me I had a pile of pages, 30 of them, all closely typed. The! I exclaimed. If that does not suit him I will give up the whole thing, and I hope it does not suit him. The next afternoon I called on Mr. B. _ again. He looked once more at my papers, then took the synopsis and settled back to read. Every so often he nodded his head approvingly, and when he had finished, said, very cautiously, I think we may be able to get it placed. Leave it with me. In the meantime write the first chapter. I did not know whether to be pleased or sorry as I walked down Regent Street towards Piccadilly Circus. Finances had reached a dangerously low point, yet I just hated the thought of writing about myself. 2 days later I received a letter from Mr. B underscore asking me to call, telling me that he had good news for me. My heart sank at the thought, so I was going to have to write that book after all. Mr. B underscore beamed benevolently upon me. "I have a contract for you," he said, "but first I would like to take you to see the publisher." Together we went off to another part of London and entered a street which used to be a fashionable district, with high houses. Now the houses were used as offices, and people who should have been living in them lived in remote districts. We walked along the street and stopped at an undistinguished-looking house. "This is it," said Mr. B underscore. We entered a dark hallway and mounted a curving flight of stairs to the first floor. At last we were shown into Mr. Publisher, who seemed a little cynical at first, only gradually warming up. The interview was of short duration and then we were back on the street. "Come back to my office, dear me. Where are my spectacles?" said Mr. B underscore, feverishly going through his pockets in search of the missing glasses. He sighed with relief as he found them, continuing, "Come back to the office, I have the contract ready to sign." At last here was something definite, a contract to write a book. I decided that I would do my part, and hoped that the publisher would do his. Certainly the third eye has enabled Mr. Publisher to put a little jam on it. The book progressed. I did a chapter at a time and took it into Mr. B underscore. On a number of occasions I visited Mr. and Mrs. B underscore at their charming home, and I would here like particularly to pay tribute to Mrs. B underscore. She welcomed me, and few English people did that. She encouraged me, and she was the first English woman to do so. At all times she made me welcome, so, thank you, Mrs. B underscore. My health had been deteriorating rapidly in London's climate. I struggled to hold on while finishing the book, using all my training to put aside illness for a while. With the book finished, I had my first attack of coronary thrombosis and nearly died. At a very famous London hospital, the medical staff were puzzled indeed by many things about me. But I did not enlighten them, perhaps this book will. "You must leave London," said the specialist. "Your life is in danger here. Get away to a different climate." "Leave London?" I thought. "But where shall we go?" At home we had a discussion, discussing ways and means and places to live. Several days later I had to return to the hospital for a final check. "When are you going?" asked the specialist. "Your condition will not improve here." "I just do not know," I replied. "There are so many things to consider." "There is only one thing to consider," he said impatiently. "Stay here and you will die. Move and you may live a little longer. Do you not understand that your condition is serious?" Once again I had a heavy problem to face. Chapter 10, Lobsang. Lobsang. I turned restlessly in my sleep. The pain in my chest was acute, the pain of that clot. Gasping, I returned to consciousness. "Returned to here again, Lobsang. My," I thought, "I feel terrible." "Lobsang," the voice went on. "Listen to me, lie back and listen to me." I lay back wearily. My heart was pumping and my chest was throbbing in sympathy. Gradually, within the darkness of my lonely room, a figure manifested itself. First a blue glow, turning to yellow, then the materialized form of a man of my own age. "I cannot astral travel tonight," I said, "or my heart will surely cease to beat and my task's not yet ended. Brother, we well know your condition, so I have come to you. Listen, you need not talk." I leaned back against the bedhead, my breath coming in sobbing gasps. It was painful to take a normal breath, yet I had to breathe in order to live. "We have discussed your problem among us," said the materialized Lama. "There is an island off the English coast, an island which was once part of the lost continent of Atlantis. Go there as quickly as you can. Rest a while in that friendly land before journeying to the continent of North America. Go not to the western shores whose coastline is washed by the turbulent ocean. Go to the Green City and then beyond." "Ireland?" "Yes. An ideal place. I had always got on well with Irish people." "Green City?" Then the answer came to me, "Dublin, from a great height, look green because of Phoenix Park and because of the River Liffey flowing from the mountains down to the sea. The llama smiled approvingly. You must recover some part of your health, for there will be a further attack upon it. We would have you live so that the task may be advanced, so that the science of the aura may come nearer to fruition. I will go now. But when you are a little recovered, it is desired that you visit again the land of the golden light. The vision faded from my sight, and my room was the darker for it, and more lonely. My sorrows had been great, my sufferings beyond the ability of most to bear or to understand. I leaned back, gazing unseeingly through the window. What had they said on a recent astral visit to Lhasa? Oh, yes. You find it difficult to obtain employment? Of course you do, my brother, for you are not part of the Western world, you live on borrowed time. The man whose living space you have taken would have died in any case. Your need, temporarily for his body, more permanently for his living space, meant that he could leave the earth with honor and with gain. This is not karma, my brother, but a task which you are doing upon this, your last life on earth. A very hard life, too, I told myself. In the morning I was able to cause some consternation or surprise by announcing, we are going to live in Ireland. Dublin first, then outside Dublin. I was not much help in getting things ready, I was very sick, and almost afraid to move for fear of provoking a heart attack. Cases were packed, tickets obtained, and at last we set off. It was good to be in the air again, and I found that breathing was much easier. The airline, with a heart case passenger aboard, took no risks. There was an oxygen cylinder on the rack above my head. The plane flew lower, and circled over a land of vivid green, fringed by milk-white surf. Lower still, and there was the rumble of an undercarriage being lowered, followed shortly by the screech of the tires touching the landing strip. My thoughts turned to the occasion of my first entry to England, and my treatment by the customs official. What will this be like? I mused. We taxied up to the airport buildings, and I was more than a little mortified to find a wheelchair awaiting me. In customs the officials looked hard at us and said, "How long are you staying?" "We have come to live here," I replied. There was no trouble, they did not even examine our belongings. The lady fascinated them all as, serene and self-possessed, she stood guard on our luggage. These Siamese cats, when properly trained and treated as beings, not just animals, are possessed of superlative intelligence. Certainly I prefer the Lady K's friendship and loyalty to that of humans. She sits by me at night and awakens my wife if I am ill. Our luggage was loaded on a taxi, and we were driven off to Dublin City. The atmosphere of friendliness was very marked, nothing seemed to be too much trouble. I lay upon my bed in a room overlooking the grounds of Trinity College. On the road below my window, traffic moved at a sedate pace. It took me some time to recover from the journey, but when I could get about, the friendly officials of Trinity College gave me a pass which enabled me to use their grounds and their magnificent library. Dublin was a city of surprises, one could buy almost anything there. There was a far greater variety of goods than there is in Windsor, Canada, or Detroit, USA. After a few months, while I was writing Doctor from Lhasa, we decided to move to a very beautiful fishing village some 12 miles away. We were fortunate in obtaining a house overlooking Ballskarden Bay, a house with a truly amazing view. I had to rest a very great deal, and found it impossible to see through the windows with binoculars because of the distorting effect of the glass. A local builder, Brad Campbell, with whom I became very friendly, suggested plate glass. With that installed, I could rest on my bed and watch the fishing boats out in the bay. The whole expanse of harbor was within my view, with the yacht club, the harbor master's office and the lighthouse as prominent features. On a clear day I could see the mountains of Mourne, away in British-occupied Ireland, while, from Howth Head, I could dimly see the mountains of Wales far across the Irish Sea. We bought a second-hand car and often journeyed up into the Dublin mountains, enjoying the pure air and the beautiful scenery. On one such trip we heard of an elderly Siamese cat who was dying from an immense internal tumor. After much pressure, we managed to take her into our household. The best veterinary surgeon in the whole of Ireland examined her but thought she had only hours to live. I persuaded him to operate to remove the tumor caused by neglect and too many kittens. She recovered, and proved to have the sweetest nature of any person or animal I have ever met. Now, as I write, she is walking round like the gentle old lady she is. Quite blind, her beautiful blue eyes radiate intelligence and goodness. The lady Kwe walks with her, or directs her telepathically so that she does not bump into things or hurt herself. We call her Granny Grey Whiskers as she is so much like an elderly granny walking around, enjoying the evening of her life, after raising many families. Howth brought me happiness, happiness that I had not known before. Mr. Loftus, the policeman, or guard as they are called in Ireland, frequently stopped to chat. He was always a welcome visitor. A big man, as smart as a guard at Buckingham Palace. He had a reputation for utter firmness and utter fearlessness. He would come in, when off duty, and talk of far off places. His "my God, doctor, ye've brains to throw away," was a delight to hear. I had been badly treated by the police of many countries, and Guard Loftus, of Howth, Ireland, showed me that there were good policemen as well as the bad which I had known. My heart was showing signs of distress again, and my wife wanted the telephone installed. Unfortunately, all the lines of the hill were in use, so we could not have one. One afternoon there came a knock at the door, and a neighbor, Mrs. O'Grady, said, "I hear you want the telephone and cannot get it. Use ours at any time you like. Here is a key to the house." The Irish treated us well. Mr. and Mrs. O'Grady were always trying to do something for us, trying to make our stay in Ireland even more pleasant. It has been our pleasure and our privilege to bring Mrs. O'Grady to our home in Canada for an all too brief visit. Suddenly, shockingly, I was taken violently ill. The years in prison camps, the immense strains I had undergone, and the unusual experiences had combined to make my heart condition serious indeed. My wife rushed up to the O'Grady's house and telephoned a doctor to come quickly. In a surprisingly short time, Dr. Chapman came into my bedroom, and with the efficiency that comes only from long years of practice, got busy with his hypodermic. Dr. Chapman was one of the old school of doctors, the family doctor who had more knowledge in his little finger than half a dozen of the factory-produced state-aided specimens so popular today. With Dr. Chapman and me it was a case of friends at first sight. Slowly, under his care, I recovered enough to get out of bed. Then came a round of visiting specialists in Dublin. Someone in England had told me never to trust myself to an Irish doctor. I did trust myself, and had better medical treatment than in any other country of the world. The personal, the human touch was there, and that is better than all the mechanical coldness of the young doctors. Brad Campbell had erected a good stone wall round our grounds, replacing a broken one, because we were sorely troubled by trippers from England. People used to come on excursions from Liverpool and enter the gardens of the Howth people and camp there. We had one tripper who caused some amusement. One morning there was a loud knock at the door. My wife answered it, and found a German woman outside. She tried to push her way in, but failed. Then she announced that she was going to camp on our doorstep until she was allowed in to sit at the feet of Lobsang Rampa. As I was in bed, and certainly did not want anyone sitting at my feet, she was asked to go. By afternoon she was still there. Mr. Loftus came along, looking very fierce and efficient, and persuaded the woman to go down the hill, get on a bus for Dublin, and not come back. They were busy days, with me trying not to overtax my strength. Doctor from Lhasa was now completed, but letters were coming in from all over the world. Past the postman would come wheezing to the door, after the long climb up the hill. "Ah, good morning to ye," he would say to whoever answered his knock, "and how is himself today? Ah, sure the letters are breaking me back." One night as I lay upon my bed watching the twinkling lights of Botmarnock, and of the ships far out to sea, I was suddenly aware of an old man sitting gazing at me. He smiled as I turned in his direction. "I have come," he said, "to see how you progress, for it is desired that you go again to the land of the golden light. How do you feel?" "I think I can manage, with a little effort," I replied. "Are you coming with me?" "No, he answered, for your body is more valuable than ever before, and I am to stay here and guard it. During the past few months I had suffered greatly. One of the causes of my suffering was a matter which would cause a Westerner to recoil in disbelief. The whole changeover of my original body had taken place. The substitute body had been teleported elsewhere and allowed to fall to dust. For those who are sincerely interested, it is an old Eastern art and can be read about in certain books. I lay for a few moments, collecting my strength. Outside the window a late fishing boat went futfooting by. The stars were bright, an island's eye was bathed in moonlight. The old man smiled and said, "A pleasant view you have here." I nodded silently, straightened my spine, folded my legs beneath me, and drifted off like a puff of smoke. For a time I hovered above the headland, gazing down at the moonlit countryside. Island's eye, the island just off the coast, farther out the island of Lamb. Behind glowed the bright lights of Dublin, a modern, well-lit city indeed. As I rose higher, slowly, I could see the magnificent curve of Killiney Bay, so reminiscent of Naples, and beyond, Greystones and Wicklow. Off I drifted, out of this world, out of this space and time. On, to a plane of existence which cannot be described in the languages of this three-dimensional world. It was like going from darkness into the sunlight. My guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, was awaiting me. "You have done so well, Lobsang, and have suffered so much," he said. "In a short time you will be returning here not to leave again. The struggle has been worthwhile." We moved together through the glorious countryside, moved to the Hall of Memories where there was much yet to learn. For some time we sat and talked, my guide, an August group, and I. "Soon," said one, "you will go to the land of the Red Indians and there we have another task for you. For a few short hours refresh yourself here, for your ordeals of late have sorely taxed your strength." "Yes," remarked another, "and be not upset by those who would criticize you, for they know not whereof they speak, being blinded by the self-imposed ignorance of the West. When death shall close their eyes, and they become born to the greater life, then indeed will they regret the sorrows and troubles they have so needlessly caused." As I returned to Ireland the land was yet in darkness, with just a few faint streaks shooting across the morning sky. Along the long stretch of sands at Clontarf the surf was breaking with a sighing moan. The head of Howth loomed up, a darker shape in the pre-dawn darkness. As I floated down, I glanced at our rooftop. "Dear me," I remarked to myself, "the seagulls have bent my aerial rods. I shall have to call in Brad Campbell to put them straight." The old man was still sitting by my bedside. Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers was sitting on the end of my bed as if on guard. As I entered my body and reanimated it, she came up to me, rubbed against me and purred. She uttered a low call, and Lady Kuei came in, jumped on the bed and took up her station on my lap. The old man gazed down upon them in marked affection and remarked, "Truly entities of a high order. I must go, my brother." The Morning Post brought a savage assessment from the Irish Income Tax Office. "The only Irish people I dislike are those connected with the tax office. They seem to me to be so unhelpful, so unnecessarily officious. For writers in Ireland, the tax is absolutely penal, and it is a tragedy, because Ireland could well do with those who would spend money. Tax or no tax, I would rather live in Ireland than in any other place in the world except Tibet." "We will go to Canada," I said. Gloomy looks greeted that statement. "How will we take the cats?" I was asked. "By air, of course, they will travel with us," I answered. The formalities were considerable, the delays long. The Irish officials were helpful in the extreme, the Canadians not at all helpful. The American consulate offered far more help than did the Canadian. We were fingerprinted and investigated, then we went for our medical examinations. I failed. "Too many scars," said the doctor. "You will have to be X-rayed." The Irish doctor who X-rayed me looked at me with compassion. "You must have had a terrible life," he said. "Those scars. I shall have to report my findings to the Canadian Board of Health. In view of your age, I anticipate that they will admit you to Canada, subject to certain conditions. The Lady Grey and Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers were examined by a veterinary surgeon and both pronounced fit. While waiting for a ruling about my case, we made inquiries about taking the cats on the plane with us. Only Swissa would agree, so we provisionally booked with them. Days later I was called to the Canadian embassy. A man looked at me sourly. "You are sick?" he said. "I have to be sure that you will not be a charge on the country." He fiddled and fiddled, and then, as if with immense effort, said, "Montreal has authorized your entry provided you report to the Board of Health immediately you arrive, and take whatever treatment they say you need. If you don't agree, you can't go," he said, hopefully. It seemed very strange to me that so many embassy officials in other countries are so needlessly offensive. After all, they are merely hired servants. One cannot always call them civil servants. We kept our intentions private. Only our closest friends knew that we were going and knew where we were going. As we knew to our cost, it was almost a case that if we sneezed, a press reporter would come hammering at the door to ask why. For the last time we drove around Dublin, and around the beauty spots of Howth. It was indeed a wrench to even think of leaving, but none of us are here for pleasure. A very efficient firm in Dublin had agreed to drive us to Shannon in a bus, us, the cats, and our luggage. A few days before Christmas we were ready to go. Our old friend Mr. Loftus came to say goodbye, and to see us off. If there were not tears in his eyes, then I was much mistaken. Certainly I felt that I was parting from a very dear friend. Mr. and Mrs. O'Grady came to see us, Mr. O'Grady taking the day off for that purpose. Viorg was openly upset. Paddy was trying to hide his emotion with a show of joviality which deceived no one. I locked the door, gave the key to Mr. O'Grady to mail to the solicitor, got in the bus and we drove away from the happiest time of my life since I left Tibet, drove away from the nicest group of people I had met in long, long years. The bus rushed along the smooth highway to Dublin, threading through the city's courteous traffic. On, and into open country skirting the mountains. For hours we drove on, the friendly driver, efficient at his task, pointing out landmarks and being solicitors of our welfare and comfort. We stopped halfway for tea. The Lady Grey likes to sit up high and watch the traffic and yell encouragement to whoever is driving her. Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers prefers to sit quietly and think. With the bus stopped for tea, there was great consternation. Where had we stopped? Was everything all right? We continued on, for the road was long and Shannon far distant. Darkness came upon us and slowed us somewhat. Late in the evening we arrived at Shannon Airport, left our main luggage, and were driven to the accommodation we had booked for the night and the next day. Because of my health and the two cats we stayed at Shannon a night and a day, leaving on the next night. We had a room each, fortunately they had communicating doors, because the cats did not know where they wanted to be. For a time they wandered around, sniffing like vacuum cleaners, reading all about people who had previously used the rooms, then they fell silent and were soon asleep. I rested the next day, and looked round the airport. The duty-free shop interested me, but I could not see the use of it. If one bought an article one had to declare it somewhere and then pay duty, so what was the gain? The Swiss officials were helpful and efficient, the formalities were soon completed and all we waited for was the plane. Midnight came and went, 1 o'clock. At 1:30 we were taken aboard a big Swiss plane, we, and our two cats. People were most impressed by them, by their self-control and composure. Not even the noise of the engines disturbed them. Soon we were speeding along the runway faster and faster. The land dropped away. The River Shannon flowed briefly beneath the wing and was gone. Before us the wide Atlantic surged, leaving a white surf along the coast of Ireland. The engine note changed, long flames trailed from the glowing exhaust pipes. The nose tilted slightly. The two cats looked silently at me. Was there anything to worry about? They wondered. This was my 7th Atlantic crossing, and I smiled reassuringly at them. Soon they curled up and went to sleep. The long night wore on. We were traveling with the darkness, for us the night would be some 12 hours of darkness. The cabin lights dimmed, leaving us with the blue glow and a faint prospect of sleep. The droning engines carried us on at 35,000 feet above the gray, restless sea. Slowly the pattern of stars changed. Slowly a faint lightning was observed in the distant sky on the edge of the Earth's curve. Bustling movement in the galley, the clatter of dishes, then, slowly, like a plant growing, came the lights.